I call them mantras, little mantras I just constantly repeat to myself. One of my mantras that I always tell to the guys that work for me, take what you do seriously, but don't take yourself seriously. My name is Vilhjálmur Hilmar Sigurðarson. For most people, William is enough. And I'm the chef of restaurant Souvenir here in Ghent.
Elk jaar brengt Fouchette getalenteerde topchefs samen die zorgen voor een unieke gastronomische beleving op een bijzondere locatie in Gent. Je maakt een keuze uit twee menus en op eigen tempo haal je de gerechten op bij de open keukens van de chefs. Wat uniek is, is dat je de chef ook kan ontmoeten. Om niet snel te vergeten dus. Meteen kon ik met hen een podcast voor Satellite Gourmet opnemen. Deze keer stelde ik enkele richtvragen over de locatie van hun zaak, wie ze echt zijn, als mens en als vakman, wat hun inspiratie is of hun keukenfilosofie, wat het team voor hen betekent en hoe ze de toekomst zien. Tot slot de uitsmijter wat ze zelf denken over Fouchette. Mijn naam is Sabine Goethals, ik ben jouw host, hoewel je me deze keer niet hoort. Ik laat de chef volledig zelf aan het woord. Luister en geniet.
We are here in the historic center of Ghent, one of the main cities of Europe already 300-400 years ago, and with its rich history. And our building is no different. Used to be a butchery for the longest of time. Actually used to have a river in between the two buildings that the restaurant is made of. And so a lot has happened in this street and in this building. We are located in the middle of the Quartier Rouge, the red light district here in Ghent, another historic part of Ghent, whether you like it or not. When you're trying to build up a restaurant, you're always looking at it from different perspectives. You think about it, first of all, how will you work as a chef within the space? How will you build a business within the space? And how will you try to translate or give a narrative to a building where it translates to your whole persona in a way? So it's a total package that needs to come together. Obviously, we were very attracted to the building itself because of its history and because of its very good location here in the center of Ghent. But beyond that, it has a very unique flow as a building. And we wanted to create a peaceful environment within it because it's quite narrow and quite small. It's an intimate restaurant, so it works very well with that in mind. And the front part of the building is actually a monument from the original butchery that was here between 1926 and 1978 or whatever it was. And so it's a little funny part of the restaurant because we don't work with meat that much. So it's funny to have the butchery imagery of the restaurant, which contradicts very much what we actually do. The name Souvenir came to us, me and my wife, when we were traveling through Iceland, actually, together with her father, who grew up in a little souvenir store in Ypres. And we were looking for a name, and naming a restaurant is harder than naming a kid. And we felt that the word souvenir translated an emotion, a memory, an emotion of experience, an emotion of thinking back to good times and sharing with people, and we felt it was a nice bridge between what we wanted to do and what gastronomy is all about. As a human being, I'm not a very social person. I'm not really fond of people. Grew up in a small village in the middle of nowhere and was used to being by myself all the time. So coming to Europe and being constantly surrounded with people is a big difference. And it's also really interesting to be a chef when you're antisocial, in fact, because people come so much for the personality behind the chef, and you are so required to be available emotionally towards people and to engage with people, which is something that I'm not very comfortable with. I'm not a very social person. Making myself available is sometimes something I struggle with. Professionally as a chef, I'm very devoted to my zeal and my ethos of a way of working and having been working in professional kitchens for better half of 20 years. It's, you build up a certain approach and a certain philosophy towards cooking. We try to create an environment which is very engaging and warm towards our staff. And we try to translate the terroir of Belgium, or the Flanders in fact, towards our customers. We are very devoted to our farmers. They are the roots of our cuisine. Without the farmers, it would be very difficult for us to have an identity, because we are so reliant on what they do and their work. So we are extremely grateful for the passion and dedication they put in their craft, because so much of the work happens in the field, and it doesn't matter how talented or how devoted or how hardworking you are. If you work with products that are inferior quality, you're always going to be limited in what you can achieve. We approach our cuisine very brutalistically, to put an architectural term into it. We look at things very pragmatically. We always look for the path of least resistance, to try to translate with the biggest clarity the flavors and the feeling of the season towards the customers. First of all, we have to come to terms with that the identity of Flemish cuisine has gone through many different permutations in the last 20, 30 years. It is a cuisine that's been struggling with itself slightly and finding itself, coming to terms with what it is. But this is not unique to Flanders. I think most regional cuisines go through a sort of an existential crisis of sort when they try to realize what they actually represent. And Iceland is no different. Iceland is an island in the middle of the North Atlantic. It's geographically challenged when it comes to just produce. Being also a part of a Danish colony until 1945, the strong Danish influence, which is not a bad thing, but it's still a thing, because Denmark also went through their own existential crisis and questions of identity. Flanders is also in between these huge superpowers, whether you want to call England, France or Germany, and there's influence from all those cultures. There's a very strong push and pull between French gastronomy and what is the identity of Flemish or Belgian cuisine. It's about maintaining a sense of character, and while using techniques from different cuisines around you. It's always interesting. I think that Iceland is still searching very strongly for its own voice when it comes to food, while Flanders is much more in a better place, to put it simply. I think in the last 10, 15 years, gastronomy here has really taken great steps forward in establishing and chiseling and polishing its identity towards the outside world. But we still lack a little bit how to communicate this identity we have towards the outside world. Towards people here, I think the identity is quite clear and it has a strong image. But outside of Belgium, it's still a little bit vague what Belgian cuisine or Flemish cuisine is. You have to be, I've sometimes said, you have to be a hopeless romantic to be a chef. Because if you don't love it, you won't last. It's a very unforgiving and uncaring profession towards you as a chef. Not that the environment or the mentality, it's just hospitality works when other people don't work. It's not very forgiving towards your family life. It's not very forgiving towards your romantic life. It's, on the whole, it's just not great if you're a very social person. So it was perfect for me because I just wanted to work and I felt comfortable at work. And I felt a sense of fulfillment in the very simple, very small, gradual improvements that you can do when you're a chef. It's very easy to become better if you just do it constantly and continuously and repetitively. Passion is a little bit of a wildfire. It spreads, it's contagious. So if you put in the right environment with the right people, it's very easy to fall in love with food, because it's so integral to us as humans, because we all eat. Not everybody reads, not everybody writes, not everybody is into architecture or beauty or in terms of art or whatever, but we all eat. And even the most pragmatic, most emotionally challenged person in the world will still have a favorite food. They will still connect emotionally to food. And that's a huge power to have, this kind of power of emotion in food, and to be able to translate emotions like nostalgia and longing and joy in food. It's really, really powerful. Now, the creative process behind our food is really dictated by our philosophy. We approach things in this kind of pragmatic, minimalistic, brutalistic way, where we try to let the ingredients talk and not us. And there's always a fine line between when is the ingredient allowed and given the space to communicate itself, or when is the chef trying to talk through the ingredient. And this nuance is maybe lost on a lot of people, but for us it's a really strong driving force. Right now we are in this transitional period where we are going from the winter period to spring. It's a really, really nice and welcome period because we've been going through a reasonably long winter, which has been quite heavy. It really starts to affect us in terms of positional flexibility when it comes to dishes, because from November on we get limited in what we can do simply because there's scarcity of products. And when it comes to this point now, end of March, we are at the finish line with what is available to us. Being creative in this period from, let's say, January to March, it's really hard, it's really difficult. Therefore we try to compensate with that by creating sort of building blocks of fermentation and of drying and of different preparations we can do over the year to put ourselves in a better situation to be flexible when it comes to this period of the year. But starting from March, the season change, and this change become more rapid. And as the availability goes up, being creative with it is way easier. And the rate where we change the menu becomes faster. And it's always this kind of push and pull with what comes in and what we have, and we try to bring it together. It's about translating the terroir towards a customer and really give a sense of the season to people. It doesn't make any sense if you come into a restaurant, you just came in from the freezing rain and you served tomatoes with a tartare of some tuna. It's just, there needs to be a connection with where you are and what you're consuming. And to give you a sense of time and place, this is a huge, core element in our philosophy. It's not a challenge, it's a discipline. Being creative within restriction can be actually more liberating, because the more you restrict your frame of operation, where you have to be active within, it gives you a more structure to be creative. People will sometimes talk to me, colleagues, that I need this and I need that, etc., etc. And I respect that. Everybody needs to find their own way, where they are comfortable, where they're able to do and what they want to do in a way that they are happy with it. But we chose to create quite a rigid frame of operation that we try to work within. It is liberating to have such restrictions that you need to work around and work with, because it motivates you to think outside the box and be creative with your limited resource. So on the contrary, it's not challenging, it is just discipline, and you get used to it in a way. Is the ability to taste singularly most important aspect of a chef? It's a really, really difficult question to pass. I think it's so fundamental. Without the ability to taste, you are so limited in what you can do, and understanding your product and finding a way forward with your product. I always say that as a chef, you need to have like this virtual palate. You have to have the ability to recall with perfect clarity ingredients in your head, so you can taste. If you think about an ingredient, you can taste that ingredient in your head and you can feel how it tastes in your mouth. You can even, the more you train this, you can even take that flavor and you can say, I'm going to take that ingredient and I'm going to treat it in this way and it's going to taste like that. You can recall it and then you can combine flavors. And most of the times, if you're very used to working with the ingredients, year after year after year after year, even we have beetroots, we only buy beetroots from one farmer. I can taste these beetroots in my head, and coming up with a dish is easy because there are so many different permutations you can do with beetroots, and if you can recall all these flavors and you can combine them with different flavors, it's easy to create dishes. It's the foundation. If you can't taste good, it's hard to be good at what you do. It's like, what is my signature? Everybody struggle with identity. We often get the remark that we do something unique, we do something else, and we are just in our own bubble in a way, so we don't experience it in that way. We do our thing. It's good that people find it unique what we do. For the last few years, there's been a hyper-visualization of food, where it's the Instagrammability of food, where everybody treat food as a visual medium. They look at it visually, primarily before taste. And they think about how they want a dish to look like before they think about how they want it to taste. And this is, for me, it's a lack of discipline there. You see the food visually before you think about it in the sensory department. And you will always lose out, because once you prioritize visualization over flavor, you will compromise towards visualization. You will compromise on everything to achieve something visually, which contradicts what you should be doing as a chef, which is about maximizing flavor. So I'm constantly asking myself, what are we doing? Where are we going? And why do we do it? So there's always a lot of reflection in what we're doing. Identity is still a very fluid concept when it comes to what we do. When you work in a restaurant, I jokingly say you spend more time with your colleagues than you do with your family. You should try to create an environment which is engaging and warm and hospitable, and an environment where people can grow and find their comfort. You cannot do what you do without the people that you surround yourself with. This is both the people that work for you and also your suppliers. These are your farmers that you work with and the people you rely on daily and weekly to be there for you. There needs to be always a sense of responsibility and respect between people. And if you build up that culture, you will find that people are loyal to you and the whole process becomes enjoyable. So why not? We are with three in the kitchen in total, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. Most of the time, that's the bottom line. For the time being, everybody have quite a fixed structure around what they do. By no means is that isolated. We all have to work together and cover for each other and collectively reach the finish line. I'm a father of three, so I've just come to terms with the fact that I cannot always be functionally available to the restaurant. With that in mind, it's about finding people that can be responsible, that can be disciplined, that can be relied upon, and figuring out a way to get these different personalities to work together and create something together. Creatively though, it's also really interesting to have more people in the room, because I always say that being creative is like you bounce a ball against the wall. If you're by yourself, you're just alone and you throw the ball and it comes right back. There's no difference in this conversation. But if you throw the ball between a few people, it's sometimes you can get different, you get to a different point, you get to a different place. And being creative as a team is fun, and it's really engaging towards the people that work for you to be a part of the conversation of what's happening. And it helps build them also for the future to be able to do their own thing, hopefully later, and find their own voice and their own cuisine. Yoko and I, we are a team. We started this restaurant 9 years ago and we complement each other quite nicely. I have my strengths and I have my weaknesses. I'm very open and honest towards myself about my weaknesses, and she has many strengths and we work together quite well. She's the beating heart of the restaurant while I'm more of the imagination of it to some degree. She's incredibly disciplined, and in her field of expertise, she's so talented, you know. She's in charge of the wine, she's in charge of the communication, she's in charge of the personnel, she's in charge of all of our bookkeeping and everything, and she does everything with gusto and great, great pride, and she's so good at it. It would be impossible for me to do this by myself. really genuinely. And I honestly wouldn't have the courage to try because she does three things at once. When it comes to the whole métier of the service and hospitality, me being very antisocial, she's an integral part, a very important driving force behind that, because she's the one that really instills the mentality of taking stress off people when they come and making them feel welcome and comfortable, which is something that I'm just not fit to do. And so there would not be a restaurant without her. The future of gastronomy is a huge conversation. You can approach it from a macro and a micro level. But first you have to acknowledge some facts. There's like 8.5 billion people on the planet by now. And that's supposed to go up by about 2.5 to 3.5 billion in the next 30 years. So by 2055, they estimate 12 billion people to live on the planet. It's a huge increase. And if you just think about some fundamental facts, like the fact that we should all be drinking 2 liters to 3 liters of water a day, and you just think about the volume of daily consumption of water, you know that there is going to be, at some point, food scarcity. This is inevitable. This is unless something changes. What changes? Well, this is a trickier question. There was an economist, his name escapes me, in the late 1700s, early 1800s. He came up with this theory about how much food can this planet, this limited resource we have, how much food can we actually make and create sustainably to sustain people, and how many people can we sustain on the planet? He calculated at that time that it was about 3.5 billion. We already exceeded that by a lot. But nevertheless, we live on a planet and it's a finite resource. So what's the future of gastronomy? Well, this is where gastronomy needs to be defined as simply a luxury. Gastronomy is the luxury manifestation of the daily consumption of food. So realistically, if there is a severe food and water scarcity in the world, gastronomy will come to an end because it's a luxury we cannot allow ourselves anymore. Is this inevitable? Probably. It's very probable. Because, yeah, is it going to be in 50 years or 100 years or 200 years? But at some point, we will reach the ceiling of what we can produce as a planet for the people that live on it. And then we cannot allow ourselves this luxury, or we shouldn't. That may be a better phrase. We might still find some Elon Musks who are absolute sociopaths and will absolutely allow themselves whatever they want because they have the money. But we probably shouldn't. The question is, how can we postpone this inevitable future as long as possible until we find another solution, whatever that solution is? I think that gastronomy will, in the coming years, transition more towards plant-based focus, where vegetables are going to play a main role, meat and fish proteins are going to become less and less part of the story, and we will ultimately transition more and more towards a sustainable, whatever that means for people, model. Of course, there's another approach to this, where you could hypothesize that, on the contrary, gastronomy will travel and evolve even further into the luxury, whereas gastronomy is going to be about the consumption of dead animals and caviar and expensive truffles that are difficult to find, etc., etc. Where this is going to be, but the problem with that hypothesis is that the pool of consumers available to afford this is going to be limited, and at a certain point you're just going to run out of customers, and you cannot do this sustainably for a long period of time. If you want a sustainable model of gastronomy for the future, and we're talking decades from now, it's highly likely we're going to have to transition more towards a plant-based model. For me personally, this is something we talk about a lot, and we think about how we want to move forward, because we see ourselves as pioneers to some degree, and we feel responsibility to try to drive the narrative in a direction where there is a way forward for all of us collectively. Because whether you like it or not, and it's just a question of time, this will happen. If the population numbers continue to go up, this will become a problem. And the first problem we will severely feel is water shortage. and this is just a fact. There are things we can change in our consumption to affect this. There are things that we can try to reduce to affect this, to try to prolong it. But unless we find another planet Earth pretty soon, we will hit the wall. But if you try to think a little bit broader in terms of, okay, cool, we're not talking about the next 5 to 7 years. What will planet Earth look like, for instance, when my son is my age? My son is 30 years younger than me. So when he's my age, 30 years from now, what does it mean, gastronomy? What does it mean, food? What does it mean, water? There are so many different paths forward possible for us. And we need to be realistic that if our attitude is, there's always a way, the wall is going to hit you before you know it. If we're not trying at least to anticipate and try to think in advance and try to plan and try to be a little bit conscious, if we're not doing that, the future is bleak. If you have kids and if you have grandkids, you should care. You should care how the world is going to look like even after you're gone, because it affects the people I hope you care for. We're constantly reevaluating and reflecting on what we do. Without doing that, you will not grow, neither as a person or as a creative person or a professional person. Without reflection, you cannot evolve. We think to ourselves what the future will look like and what it entails, and we think about different ways to move forward. We ask ourselves all these questions. I don't have the answers yet. If I would have the answers, I wouldn't be a chef. I'd be a much more important person somewhere else. Get a nicer paycheck, probably. But we still think very strongly about how can we be a net positive in this story? How can we, you know, help achieve a better future for everyone? These are important questions. It's really important we have this conversation. We are now in a place where we should just enjoy and create memories and appreciate the moment, because we come from a difficult few years. Collectively as a society, and I think it's time now to a little bit let go and enjoy, and then move forward collectively together later on a little bit. Just have fun for time being. That's good. Fourchette obviously has become a very important day on the calendar every year now. I think this is the fourth or fifth iteration of it, and it's become a calling card event where we can really highlight the creative gastronomy scene here in Ghent and further, and really bring people together. As such, it's a wonderful event, and it's so well organized, which is something that you cannot emphasize it strongly enough, how important and how valuable it is that Fourchette is run by professionals who are deeply dedicated to what they do, and they do it outstandingly well. It's for us something we take great pride in being a part of, because we are proud of what we do, and we are proud of being a part of this community that really is here to promote the good things in life, but also hopefully the better things in life, you know, for all of us. Better for not just how it is to consume it, but better that leads to a better future. We think it's important to be a part of the fine dining gastronomy scene, because it's easier for us to translate our story to people when they see that we stand shoulder to shoulder with other professionals who are as good as and as dedicated to their craft as we are. So for the guests, I just hope you enjoy it. I hope you have a beautiful day and you have so much fun. You have a lot of stories to tell you, all your friends, because food is still most importantly about sharing. It's about creating memories. It's about creating little souvenirs for you to take home. And that's what Fourchette is all about.
Dit was het dan voor deze episode. Wil je meer weten over het event Fourchette? Ga dan naar de site thisisfourchette.be. En wat Satellite Gourmet betreft, abonneer je op je favoriete luisterkanaal of het YouTube-kanaal. Blijf up to date door deze podcast te volgen via Instagram, Facebook en LinkedIn. Alles kun je ook beluisteren en bekijken op de site satellitegourmet.com. Tot de volgende!